We're so glad you're here to listen to this week's sermon from Park Street Church. Park Street is a historic congregation located in the heart of Boston. But more than that, we're a community of people from all different backgrounds who believe and are united by the good news that Jesus is Lord. If you're asking questions about God, your faith, or the meaning and purpose of life, we would love to connect with you. Visit us at parkstreet.org to learn about our community. We hope this sermon encourages you today.
Well, the question of how we encounter hardship in the Christian life is an ever-present question because we live in a world that is full of trouble and trial. And we just read from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, what we call 2 Corinthians, and we saw this catalog of Paul's own trials and troubles. And it's safe to say that sometimes we think, oh, if I follow Jesus or if I come into the Christian life, then all of my troubles are going to go away. And I think for those of you who may be in the room who are exploring the Christian faith, it's important that we're upfront with you and say that's actually not what the Bible teaches and not what we would teach either. And those who have walked with Jesus in the room for a long time know that. You know that there are often times where you're in quite a bit of trouble and challenge and wrestling with opposition and struggling to know what does it look like to walk faithfully through these challenging moments. And how do I respond? We are in a series on the book of Exodus, and we spent the last 2 weeks with Moses at the burning bush, this narrative where Moses is commissioned by God and sent by God to play a key role in God's work of liberating his people out of slavery in Egypt. And we're picking up that narrative again today, now in chapter 5. And as we do so, after Moses has been reunited with his brother Aaron, after he's been saved by his wife Zipporah, after he's shown the signs that God gave him through Aaron to the people of Israel, and they've believed in him. That trust that Moses has been encouraged to have, as we saw in those 2 weeks with him at the burning bush, as God revealed himself, he was inviting Moses to trust him. That trust becomes deeply tested. And not just for Moses, but for the whole of the people of Israel, as we'll see in chapter 5. Because when Moses confronts Pharaoh, things don't go as he expects or as he thought they should. In fact, things get quite a bit worse. And so we get to watch Moses encountering this situation of intensifying opposition and crisis. And we see something of a pattern that is actually part of what the Christian life entails, which is this: there's a confrontation, and then there's opposition, and then there's wrestling between Moses and God. You know, we saw how deeply Moses wrestled with God at the burning bush, how honest and raw he was. And what we'll find at the end of our text here as we come to the end of chapter 5 and the first verse of chapter 6 is Moses is just as raw and honest. We've come to expect that this is what that relationship is like between Moses and the God of Israel. And in many ways, it offers a model for us as we think about what it looks like for us to walk by faith, especially through challenges, that we are to wrestle and be raw and honest before God. So I want to keep in mind our larger context of walking in opposition, dealing with suffering and challenges, as we look then at the people of Israel as they encounter a deeper kind of opposition here in chapter 5. And this text breaks down into three basic sections. There's first the confrontation, and then there's the outworking of the intensification of difficulty or oppression in the middle section, and then the final section we'll take a closer look at that dialogue between Moses and Yahweh, the God of Israel. So let's start in verse 1 of chapter 5. If you've got your text and the Bible open, I'd encourage you to open up and follow along. Moses and Aaron speak to Pharaoh on God's behalf. And the basic point here is this question of, well, who rules? Who's in charge? Who is the sovereign king that demands ultimate allegiance? Is it Pharaoh, the king of Egypt? Or is it Yahweh, the God of Israel? That's the question that's being displayed before us here. And we see it so clearly in the first two verses. They say to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go," which could be send off my people or release my people. It's an imperative. It's a command that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh doesn't like being told what to do. Surprise. Most totalitarian dictators do not. And so his response basically sets the turn or lays the battle out before us. But Pharaoh said, verse 2, take a look, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go. I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. The swords have been drawn in the duel that will now occupy the narrative from this moment at the beginning of chapter 5 all the way through the end of chapter 14 and really into chapter 15 as Israel celebrates Yahweh's victory. But that's what's going to take place, and most of us are familiar with this part of Exodus. We know the story of deliverance through God's striking or the plagues on Israel, and we'll take a closer look at this a bit more next week. But this is set up right here in chapter 5 as the confrontation happens. Moses and Aaron say, no, there is another king. There's another ruler. There's another authority in life. And to him we owe allegiance. And by the way, Pharaoh, you owe allegiance too. He says, let my people go. And you should obey him. Pharaoh says, I don't know that king. Why should I obey his voice? I do not know him, and I will not let his people go. So here we have the conflict laid out for us in bare terms. Now, very quickly, let me observe that Moses and Aaron went a little bit further than they had been authorized to go in their laying down the words of that they speak to Pharaoh. Take a look back at chapter 3 with me if you've got the Bible open, and let's look at verse 18, because they're told there what they're supposed to say. God tells Moses, and you and the elders of Israel should go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Well, Moses and Aaron didn't follow the directions here. Number one, the elders weren't with them when they spoke to Pharaoh here in chapter 5. Number two, they were told to say please, and they certainly didn't. They just laid down a command from Yahweh. And then further, they actually say they're going to go have a feast or a festival rather than to go out and sacrifice. So for whatever reason, and again, I don't want to make too big of a deal of this, but I just thought it'd be worth observing it since we want to follow the text. They don't say what they're supposed to say. After Pharaoh rebuffs them and says, no, I'm not doing what you say, notice what they do in verse 3. They actually do follow what God told them to do. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But then they still add more, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. So they do back off eventually, but they start with a little bit more bravado. And I wonder, and I'm not sure if the outcome would have been any different if they had started the way they were told to start. Probably would have been quite similar after all. But it does beg the question, why did they overreach? Why did they overplay their hand a little bit as they began this confrontation? And I do have to wonder, were they getting a little arrogant, perhaps? Think about it. They had come back to Israel, and they had thrown the staff down, and it became a serpent. Then Moses did the hand trick with the hand in and out, and it had a disease, and then it was fine. And the people believed them. I mean, Moses thought they weren't going to believe, so they believed him. I mean, at the end of chapter 4, they're feeling pretty confident, pretty strong. All of God's people have gotten behind them. And it almost seems like they went to Pharaoh, and they decided that they would speak a little bit more boldly and brashly. And I wonder, it wouldn't be the first time that ministry leaders have let God's blessing get to their heads and then began to get sloppy or sit loose on following his ways. And that could be going on here with Moses and Aaron. We don't know for sure, but it's important just to notice the detail and to ask the question, do we too sometimes, maybe especially when things are going well, sit loose on the commands of God? Well, whether they went too far or not, the fact is they reflect the core of our interfacing with the world. We, as followers of Jesus, we have a message to proclaim to the world, and it is fundamentally this: Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Lord. And what that means when we make that proclamation in obedience to him is that no one else is Lord. No other authority, no other entity has that right to our ultimate allegiance in the world. And when we go out and proclaim the gospel that Jesus is Lord to all the nations and to everyone in our nation and to our own hearts, we are confronting the powers of evil, whatever way they are manifest, and making claims that those do not have the right to tell us what to do. And that's what we are called to do, what Moses and Aaron are saying here to Pharaoh. Look, there's another king. You may not know him, but I'm telling you that his name. They demand these other powers demand, like Pharaoh did, unflinching loyalty and allegiance. And when we don't bow the knee to those authorities, when we acknowledge that ultimate allegiance is given to Jesus and to Jesus alone, then that can produce and does produce conflict for Moses and Aaron, for the Apostle Paul, and for you and me in today's world. We can never give absolute allegiance to anyone or anything else. And that actually renders the relationship between the people of God and political power complex, actually. Christopher Watkin, who wrote a book a few years ago and some commentary on cultural engagement for Christians, wrote this. He said, "Nevermore can the allegiance of God's people to a human political cause, regime, or individual be absolute, however noble it may seem. In this sense, God's call for his people to serve him is politically subversive, cutting against the grain of the modern tendency to invest political agendas with ultimate salvific meaning." End quote. The Christian witness always is a confrontation to the powers of this world. A great example of this is actually from missionaries that are connected to Park Street in our own history. In 1840, in what was then known as Constantinople, we call it Istanbul today, but it was the capital of the Ottoman Empire. And Dr. Schoeffler, who was sent there, who had actually, before he went, preached for 6 months here at Park Street Church, but was sent to be a part of a mission movement to Armenian people in Constantinople. And his colleague, Dr. Hamlin, were partners in this work. And Dr. Hamlin's tutor in Armenian was a Russian. And the Russian Empire was not friendly with the Ottoman Empire, and this was a time where the Russian Empire was certainly in the ascendancy. And his tutor in Armenian was a Russian man who was seized and deported to Siberia. So Dr. Hamlin and Dr. Schoeffler were upset about this, and they went to see the Russian ambassador in Constantinople. And the Russian ambassador said to them, "My master, the Emperor of Russia, will never allow Protestantism to set foot in Turkey." To which Dr. Schoeffler replied in what became quite well known, at least back then, "Your Excellency, the Kingdom of Christ, who is my master, will never ask the Emperor of all of Russia where it may set its foot." It's a confrontation with claims to ultimate power and allegiance. It's saying, no, there's another Lord, another King, and we bow to him and to him alone in an ultimate sense, and therefore it creates a confrontation with the powers of this age. Dr. Schoeffler would not bow down, though when he said that, I neglected to tell you, he was prostrate. He bowed down before the ambassador when he said those provocative words. But he wouldn't ultimately bow down, and neither will we. And Moses and Aaron are making that claim here to Pharaoh. There is another authority, and Pharaoh doesn't like it. And he clamps down, a bit like King Herod, if you were in Sunday school in Matthew chapter 2, clamps down after another king is proclaimed who was born in Bethlehem, mimicking, no doubt, an Egyptian king long ago who had clamped down in a similar way and killing all the Hebrew male children ages 2 years old and under. Pharaoh clamps down. He tightens the screws. And that's what happens in verses 4 through 9. He claims that you're being lazy or idle, so I'll teach you. And in verse 6, he reveals to us a little bit of that system of oppression that held God's people in bondage and slavery. There were foremen and there were taskmasters. The taskmasters likely were Egyptians. The foremen were Hebrews who worked for the Egyptians. And they were part of the system of oppression that required God's people to be making bricks to build Pharaoh's cities. And they will continue to make bricks, Pharaoh says. Only now they must go, verse 7, and gather straw for themselves. But despite the straw being taken away, the number of bricks required will not be reduced. And Pharaoh's perception of all of this is clarified in verse 9. He wants the people to be busy at their labors. Why? Look at the last part of verse 9. "Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it," and what? Pay no regard to lying words. Pharaoh's saying it's a lie that there's another authority in this land who has authority over you. I am the ultimate ruler and authority, and you owe me your complete and full and final allegiance. I don't want the people who are serving me to fall prey to lying words. So he tightens the screw, and this leads us into the next section, which is really about this oppression getting worked out more and more. It's actually, there's an intentional contrast in verse 10 to verse 1. How do Moses and Aaron begin, even if they shouldn't have? They say, thus says Yahweh in verse 1. In verse 10, the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, what do they say? Thus says Pharaoh. There they are. The conflict will ensue between Yahweh, Pharaoh. Thus says Pharaoh. What does he say? I will not give you straw. Go and get straw for yourselves wherever you can, but your work will not be reduced in the least. So the people panic, no doubt, and they scatter around to find straw. And under these new conditions, they are, of course, unable to produce the quota of bricks, which hasn't been reduced. And the result is that the foremen in verse 14 were beaten. And in those circumstances, the foremen, no doubt, with quite a bit of boldness, they go to Pharaoh and they cry out to him, why do you treat your servants like this? And notice they describe themselves as servants of Pharaoh, when we know that the deepest way that they are servants of God the Most High. But they say, the fault is with your own people. Of course, they probably did know that it wasn't just with the Egyptians, it was with the king of Egypt. So we applaud their boldness of going in to confront Pharaoh about this, but Pharaoh just doubles down on the new policy. And he says to them, the request to stop your laborers is just showing how idle you really are. And in verse 19, the foremen acknowledge that they were really in difficult straits at this point. Look at verse 19. The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, you shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day. So they come out of the palace, and Moses and Aaron are just hanging out, waiting for them to come out and find out what happened in the palace. And they express their anger to Moses and Aaron. Verse 20, they met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh, and they said to them, the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. They're basically saying to Moses and Aaron, how dare you? This is not deliverance. You've only made our already difficult situation even more difficult and untenable. And let's remember, when they protest to Pharaoh and when they protest to Moses and Aaron, their backs are no doubt still bloody from the beating that they had already received. This was not an easy position for them to be in. The oppression of Pharaoh was extreme. And I think we can sympathize with the foremen. And we understand that they're upset. Moses and Aaron, if it wasn't for your going in and confronting Pharaoh, we could still do even what was a difficult job to do. But how are we to continue? May Yahweh judge you, they say. It's your fault. And that leads then to the third and final section where I want to spend a little bit of time, which is Moses and his engagement with the Lord, starting in verse 22. We can imagine that Moses and Aaron also feel like they're in a pretty difficult place as well, confronting the realities of the difficulties of what's going on with the foreman and with their people. I mean, didn't God say that his people would be delivered? And this, of course, again, isn't deliverance. So Moses, in verse 22, begins to wrestle with the sense of opposition and a sense of dissonance between what he expected and what is going on. It's a very honest conversation, which is typical for Moses and his Lord. He is honest and transparent. He is raw. And God, even though impatient and even though angered, as we saw last week in chapter 4, God is still gracious and merciful and willing to work with Moses. And we find that same kind of dynamic here and are therefore, I would say, encouraged to follow Moses' example, especially when we're struggling in the face of trouble, hardship, opposition, oppression, injustice, to trust God. We're encouraged to be honest and raw before him. So what does Moses say? And we'll try to draw a few lessons out of this for our own lives. O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. Moses knows that this latest oppressive policy of Pharaoh is Pharaoh's fault and responsibility. So he says in verse 23, did you see that? Pharaoh, he has done evil to this people. But he also knows that Pharaoh would not have introduced this policy if God had not sent Moses, and Moses had not spoken to Pharaoh. So he says in verse 22, "Why have you," that is Yahweh, "why have you done evil to this people?" There's a tension there, isn't there? And what's going on, what I hope to encourage us is, in times of trouble and trial, Moses is leaning into something deeply significant about the sovereignty of God. In reflecting on this tension, Old Testament commentator Christopher Wright writes, "This will not be the last time that the Old Testament affirms the mysterious relationship between evil events that are the product of human sin, arrogance, or violence on the one hand, and the sovereign overarching will of God on the other," end quote. We see it in the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon, but climactically, and it's no surprise to me that we see it here at the beginning of this great, the greatest act of salvation in the Old Testament, because this becomes the paradigm for the greater act of salvation in the New Testament. We see it climactically, this kind of tension or mystery, in the very act of God in which he rescues his world from sin and evil and death through the death and resurrection of his son. Peter, at that sermon on the day of Pentecost, the very first Christian sermon, says this to those who are listening to him, to those in Jerusalem. He says, "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." That is, you committed evil acts against him, but these evil acts were also according to God's sovereign, overarching purposes. Though we rightly bristle at any evil whatsoever being attributed to God, who we know as perfectly good and against evil, we can also take comfort in the consistent teaching of the Bible that God's sovereignty, and thus his ability to work in and through the hardships of our lives for his good purposes and pleasure, that God's sovereignty encompasses and is unable to be thwarted by the violent, oppressive, and unjust acts of human beings. And this should be doubly encouraging to us on this side of the cross when we realize that God's greatest act of redemption, the greater Exodus, was an act in which these very evil and sinful and unjust actions were utilized to accomplish an even greater, more glorious, more comprehensive act of life and blessing. The fact that this tension is found right here at the heart of God's salvific action in the Old Covenant and in the New Covenant, right at the heart of our faith, should give us reassurance and comfort in the sovereign hand and purposes of God when we walk through our own valleys of the shadow of death. Yes, there is mystery in this affirmation from Moses, but there is even more comfort for you, for me, for Moses. Moses is wrong as he finishes in saying in verse 23, "And you have not delivered your people at all." Had he not heard what Yahweh had said to him in verse 19 of chapter 3? "But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand." Had he not heard what Yahweh declared to him in verse 21 of chapter 4? "But I will harden his," that is Pharaoh's heart, "so that he will not let the people go." We might come back to that more next week. In fact, God's purposes in his self-disclosure to Moses were to be worked out, as God himself said, through an increasing conflict with Pharaoh, through which God would become known not only to Pharaoh, to whom he is currently unknown, but also to Israel, who doesn't know him as well as they should, and also through this action to the whole world and to every onlooker ever since. That includes you and me. Moses might not have said, had he been listening a little more closely through this initial setback, what he says to Yahweh here. "Why did you ever send me?" he says. But I love the way that God responds, because instead of belittling Moses, maybe for, "Why didn't you listen to me earlier?" or even instead of directly answering Moses' complaints, God speaks in verse 1 of chapter 6 with words that reassure him and comfort him. They don't answer the question, but here's what he says. "But the Lord said to Moses, 'Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land.'" The key word here in God's response to Moses is "now." That first word that God speaks, now. Now, Moses. Now, this is a contrast. It's a turning of the page from the dire and dismal situation that had been encountered in chapter 5. Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. There is increased opposition. There is evil. But this is not a sign that in any way, shape, or form, I have lost control. I know it feels like it. I know you can't seem to figure out why I'm allowing such things to happen in your life. I know you don't understand what's going on. I know the pain and the loss and the trauma are real and that you have genuine and legitimate questions. And I know you're asking why, Moses, which Moses does twice, doesn't he, at the beginning of his speech. Why have you done this evil? Why did you ever send me? Moses asks why. And that's okay. It's okay to ask why. Asking why is not just affirmed here by Moses in his response to God. It's affirmed by the very human and very raw words of the psalmists who over and over again are willing to be bold enough with the Lord to ask this question. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? That's Psalm 10. Why have you forgotten me? Psalm 42. Why are you sleeping, O Lord? Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and oppression? Psalm 44. Why do you cast us off forever? Why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Psalm 74. But the ability in wrestling with God in faith as we walk through times of trial and trouble to be able to ask the question why honestly in a dialogue with the God whom we worship and serve, and not to see that as an act of infidelity, is most deeply affirmed not by the words of Moses, not by the words of the psalmist, it's by the words of God himself when he takes on human flesh and he hangs on a Roman cross. He takes the words of the psalmist from Psalm 22 upon his own lips and says, my God, why have you forsaken me? This kind of wrestling is actually the sign of a deep and vibrant faith with Moses and with us as we engage with God, as we walk through this valley of the shadow of death in which we do experience oppression and injustice and difficulty and confusion and dissonance in all sorts of ways. It's okay for us to wrestle with the Lord. But just because we are able to say with Moses and with Jesus, why, doesn't mean that we'll get an answer. Did Job ever get an answer to his question? Well, you might say on the one hand, no, he didn't. But on the other hand, yes, he did. It just wasn't the answer that he was looking for. It wasn't a rational explanation of his experience, which he felt was in some ways contrary to what it meant to be a faithful follower of Yahweh. But it was the presence of God unveiled before him. Moses doesn't get an answer to his question, but what does he receive? God says to him, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. In other words, this evil which God has allowed in his sovereign will is not going to have the last word. For with, or we could say on account of, a strong hand, Pharaoh will send them out. With, or account of, or through a strong hand, this is Pharaoh will drive them out of his land, God reassures Moses in verse 1. God will engage Pharaoh with a mighty hand, and this mighty hand will compel Pharaoh to acknowledge that God does exist, that he has true authority over all of creation, including over his own kingdom and realm, and that he must do what God commands. Instead of ignoring him as he is doing now, he will come to obey him, though he will regret it and it will eventually cost him his own life. For God will act. And that's what God says to Moses' question of why. Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. God will act in a manner that Pharaoh cannot ignore. When Jesus, the greater Moses, cries out why on the cross, notice that God does not answer directly. In fact, it seems for the moment at least that God does not hear the cry because Jesus breathes his last, surrenders up his spirit, and is buried into a tomb, laid in a tomb. But in a way, we can see that God does say to Jesus' own question, why? Now you will see what I will do. Because 3 days later, God intervenes and acts in a manner that brings life and release from oppression to everyone who would truly trust in him. Jesus is resurrected on the third day. And now we have seen what God has done. And what God has done is an answer to every why that has ever been asked from the beginning of time, and every why that will ever be asked to the end of time until Jesus returns. We have seen what God has done in his response to evil, and it is glorious and good. It is transformational. It is life and blessing to so many. It is the fulfillment of all of his promises, especially his promise to create a worldwide family of blessing through the seed of Abraham. And it is guaranteed. The answer to Moses reassures him that God is still sovereign, still acting, not in any way surprised by the increased oppression that Moses and his people face. The answer to Jesus's why has reverberated throughout the centuries to reassure us that whatever kind of oppression, trouble, and trial we may experience, whatever suffering or hardship is on our lives personally and in the world generally, that God is bringing about a better day. Now you will see what I will do, he says to Moses. But to every one of us on this side of the cross and resurrection of Jesus, God says, now you have seen what I have done, and you will see what I will do, meaning Jesus is coming back. And we live in between that time when God's great and climactic action against evil, which the plagues in Egypt are only a preliminary sign pointing toward a greater work in which he will strike evil to the core. And the day when God will return and consummate and complete that which he has accomplished and in victory done at the cross and the resurrection. And we live in between those times. And so when we cry out why in the wrestling of our faith, we can still look to what God has done in the past and anticipate what God will do in the future, and so find the desperate and needed reassurance and comfort that we need to bear up our cross as we confront the powers of the age. To be a disciple is to take up the cross with Jesus. It is to claim and proclaim that he and he alone is Lord to every power that is not him. And in so doing, to stand faithfully with him and bearing the cross with him. Evil will never have the last word. Evil does not have the last word. So as we wrestle in our faith, we are invited to consider God's response to all evil, and to affirm his sovereignty and his lordship, and to continue to trust him and offer him and him alone our ultimate allegiance. He is the God who is faithful. He is the God who brings life out of death. He is the God who can be trusted. And he says that to Moses again. Now, Moses, now you will see what I will do. Let's pray. Father, we have seen what you have done, and we thank you for it. And for those in the room today who feel perhaps a bit like Moses and Aaron, the foreman, and all of Israel in Exodus chapter 5, and who are crying out in anguish to you, why? Lord, I pray that that today you would reveal to them again the glorious provision that you have given to them and to all of us in your Son Jesus and in his resurrection from the dead, his defeat of sin and evil and death, his inauguration of a kingdom of blessing and life into which we have all been received by faith. Lord, encourage your people with that reality and renew our hope in what is to come, that whatever you ask us to walk through, whatever cross that you are asking us to bear, we might be able to say that it is indeed well with our soul, because you are on the throne. We trust you and we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.